Viras Mehta talks on the Buddha's lesser discourse on the void.
We will start with what is called the Chula Sunyata Sutta, the lesser discourse on the Sunyata, the void. This takes place in Savatthi, in the eastern monastery, in the palace of Migara's mother. It is important to note that the Buddha is talking with Ananda. His beloved disciple, his own cousin. And it starts off in the usual way. Then the Venerable Ananda, emerging from solitary meditation towards evening, approached the Lord, having sat down at a respectful distance, and so forth. Ananda speaks thus to the Lord. At one time, revered sir, the Lord was staying among the Sakyans. Nagaraka is the name of a market town of the Sakyans. And while I was there, revered sir, face to face with the Lord, I heard. And of course, he is repeating the words of the Buddha to the Buddha. I, Ananda, through abiding in emptiness, am now abiding in the fullness thereof. Through abiding in emptiness, I am now abiding in the fullness thereof. And then Ananda says, I hope that I heard this properly, revered sir, learnt it properly, attended to it properly, and understood it properly. And the Buddha answers, certainly, Ananda, you heard this properly, learnt it properly, attended to it properly, and understood it properly. And he repeats the words which he spoke to Ananda some time previously. Formerly, I, Ananda, as well as now, through abiding in emptiness, abide in the fullness thereof. It's a strange thing. And he goes on to say, as this palace of Migara's mother is empty of elephants, cows, horses and mares, empty of gold and silver, of assemblages of men and women, and there is only this that is not emptiness, that is to say, the solitude grounded on the order of monks. Grounded on, in this context, means dependent upon, contingent upon, the order of monks. Even so, Ananda, a monk not attending to the perception of village, of human beings, attends to solitude grounded on the perception of forest. The perception of forest means the awareness of forest. The monk is in the forest. And there are other people around him, and there is a village nearby, not attending to those, but being aware of the forest as a whole, his solitude is dependent upon the perception of forest only. His mind is satisfied with, pleased with, set on and freed in the perception of forest. Now, this does not mean that he is undergoing a wonderful pleasure or any such thing. His mind is pleased, satisfied with this awareness of forest as such. He comprehends that the disturbances there might be resulting from the perception of village do not exist here, nor from the perception of human beings. Those disturbances do not exist here. Let's take an analogy out of our own experience. When we are all together in the dining room, 150 of us or however many there are, we are all talking away. There is the clatter of knives and forks and so on, loud laughter. And these are all the disturbances that one feels if one is aware of the people, the knives, and so on. But if one is aware only in terms of dining, of the dining room as a whole, or of the meal as such, then there are no disturbances. So he comprehends, the monk comprehends, this perceiving is empty of the perception of village. It's empty of the perception of human beings, and there is only this that is not emptiness, namely the solitude dependent upon the perception of forest. You get the idea? Awareness, clear awareness, full attention upon the whole, in which the parts are included, renders the separate parts as empty in relation to his consciousness. This is void. These parts are void with respect to his awareness. He regards that which is not there as empty of it. But in regard to what remains, that is in this case the forest as such, he comprehends that being this is. Now the reference here, there is no further explanation, that being, the forest being, there is only this degree of disturbance, namely the perception of the forest as a whole. Thus, Ananda, this comes to be for him a true, not a mistaken, and utterly purified realization of emptiness. There is a true, purified realization of emptiness with respect to the village, with respect to human beings. Thus far, it is a true realization. Now we go on. And again, Ananda, a monk not attending to the perception of human beings not to the perception of forest, attends to solitude grounded on, that is dependent upon, the perception of earth. Now he takes the earth in which there is the forest, the village, the human beings. The village and the human beings are out, and the forest was there, and that was the disturbance. Now he maintains his awareness in terms of the earth itself, which contains all this, a still larger wholeness, so to say. Curious phrase, still larger wholeness, but nevertheless, you know what I mean. Perception of earth. Even so, Ananda, a monk, not attending to anything on this earth, dry land and swamps, rivers and marshes, etc., etc., hills and plains and so forth, he attends to solitude grounded on the perception of earth as a whole. We can extend this to the whole earth, to the whole world, this planet on which we live. We have, on past occasions, done what I have named the earth meditation. Many of you might remember that, in which one includes the whole world. And in this awareness, just awareness, not a silent chatter in the brain about the earth as a whole, but just aware, here is the planet as a whole. Then all the separate parts cease to be sources of disturbance. His mind is satisfied with, pleased with, set on, and freed, he always says that, and freed in the perception of earth. And then the same sort of formula gets repeated, the disturbances of such and such. But insofar as he does not attend to all those, but attends only to earth as a whole, the only disturbance is that which is consequent upon being aware of the earth as a whole. To that extent, there is not emptiness. Where all the other things are concerned, there is a state of emptiness, a void. And with respect to the earth, then, he comprehends that being this is. That is to say, that perception of earth as a whole being present, there is this disturbance with respect to that perception. Thus, Ananda, there comes to be for him a true an utterly purified realization of the concept of emptiness. Now, the word which is used for solitude is ekatta, which also means aloneness, unity, oneness. It's important to bear this in mind. Unity, aloneness, is also the same as voidness. Is it not true that it is only in terms of being conscious of otherness, another person, another thing, that there isn't the state of perfect unity? The unity of the universe is an extraordinarily comprehensive reality. The universe, the one, is the many in complete relationship with each other and with the whole. Therefore, there is an aloneness, a oneness. The universe is the absolute fact as regards our existence. Whence emerges the break in that unity, the sundered state. And the sundered state is the state of sin, remember. The word sin, its original meaning, is that which breaks the unity, or that which separates out and loses complete relationship. That is the meaning of the word sin. Now, whence emerges this state? In the mind, in consciousness. Vijnana, you know, is the fifth aspect of the Buddhist analysis of the individual. Vijnana, the fifth, is discriminative consciousness, the separating consciousness, the analyzing consciousness. And this analyzing consciousness is with us as we perceive something, as we react to any particular feeling or sensation or stimulus. So you see, this process of so-called abstraction is in reality not an escape from all that there is, but a process of unification, restoring the unity by realizing emptiness of the particular part of which we are discriminatively conscious. When that discriminative consciousness gives place to this state of total awareness, which is quite different, remember, from discriminative consciousness, then, because you abide in that emptiness, you are abiding in the fullness whereof, the unknown, the mysterious, the untalkable fullness. Nothing to do with vacuity. It is nothing to do with any idea of absolute non-existence. This is something to experience, to realize, make real. That's what the word realize means, actually. So you see, this process of abstraction, I'm using the word which scholars ordinarily use, is not abstraction in the sense in which the analytical intellectualist uses it. It is a dissolution of that mode of awareness, discriminative consciousness, as we have it, the dissolution of that discriminative consciousness, which releases the state of total awareness, which in actual fact frees us from the disturbances caused because of discriminative consciousness. And so oneself is in complete accord with the total reality. To put it as close to the truth as I possibly can, it is the totality which comes to self-realization through the particular. you yourself. And it is only man who can do that. That is to say, it is only man who can allow that to happen through meditation, which is based and must necessarily be based upon complete purification. When the purification is there, the meditation becomes possible. Not that stage one is purification. Having done all that, you go up into the next class or into the office upstairs where you have more greater responsibility and stage two starts. No, it's not like that. It all happens simultaneously. The universal process is simultaneous. No part of the universe stops. No part of your body ever stops functioning. It's perpetually functioning. So you see, this wholeness, holiness, comes to fruition gradually. And so, the Buddha goes on, and the next step after earth is the solitude, the oneness or unity, grounded on the plane of infinite akasha. I'm deliberately using the Pali word, which is also the Sanskrit word. What is akasha? It is translated as space. That is not an incorrect translation at all in the commoner garden sense. It is also translated as sky. The sky which we see outside there like that is akasha. But the word akasha used in this context has a far profounder and a far deeper meaning than the ordinary commoner garden meaning. The root of the word akasha is kash, meaning to shine. Now the extraordinary thing in connection with this word akasha is this, that it represents that which is self-shining. It is one of the strange things in all the Indian philosophical systems, as well as the philosophy of religion, that akasha is presented as an absolute, just as complementing it or purporting to complement it, nirvana is an absolute in Buddhist teaching, an absolute in the sense that it is not dependent upon anything at all. It is the not dependence, but not contingency, which makes it the absolute. You know how in the theistic theologies of the world, the universe, the world is contingent upon God, the ultimate. Existence, the word existence means actually to stand out of, ex out of sistere, to stand out of. And that which stands out of is that which has been created, if you like to use that word, or emerges out of the unknown, the indescribable, the absolute, the self-subsistent. You see? In that sense, absolute. So nirvana in Buddhism, Brahman in the Hindu teaching, Eckhart's Gottheit, Godhead as contrasted with God, the presented, personalized God, and so forth. They are absolutes, the terms for the absolute. But they are terms which are thought of if you try to develop any ideas out of them in personalistic terms. So you get your personal being, who is the supreme, ultimate being. If you don't want to personalize it, you are left with the absolute of the philosopher, or to use the phrase which that English philosopher Hamilton used, the unconditioned. The unconditioned. Now, those old people asked the question, but what does this physical universe emerge out of? Because we see that the physical, that the universe we experience through our senses and through our intellectual perception is something which begins, proceeds, dies. And yet it never ceases to be. It is always there. What does it emerge out of? They postulated Akasha as the origin of it. This self-shining, self-subsistent absolute, which is the origin of the manifested universe as such. They were in a fix. Up till the end of the 19th century, matter was different forever and ever from mind. And although in the Upanishads, Brahman is presented as being the total totality, if I may use such a phrase, is presented as the total totality, nevertheless, they couldn't really square intellectually this separation between what was absolute spirit on the one hand and matter on the other hand. So they postulated Akasha, which of course is a bit absurd. You can't have two absolutes, because then you totally deny the meaning of the word absolute. You can't have two absolutes. So now, this plane of infinite Akasha is a phrase which refers to Akasha, that self-shining, self-subsisting reality out of which all visible, audible, tangible, the tangible universe emerges. It's the root of matter, the root of nature. Remember that in those days, matter was something which was only solid, liquid, gaseous for them. They knew no different. We know something quite different now. Science, modern science, has quite dematerialized matter. Science, and just putting these ideas in order that one may try and appreciate, one may appreciate how and why those old people talked in terms of these planes of Akasha. Now notice, the same process goes on, you know, the emptiness and only this that is not emptiness. Mm-hmm. Now we come to Akasha as not emptiness. And the next stage presented is that not attending to the plane of infinite Akasha, the monk attends to infinite vijnana, to infinite discriminative consciousness. And as a matter of fact, in Buddhist teaching, infinite Akasha and infinite vijnana go together. They are always in actuality associated together. But what do you mean by infinite discriminative consciousness? Can we conceive it? Can we imagine it? You see, this is right beyond conception and imagination, isn't it? What has happened is that all the sense functions have stopped. That is to say, they are no longer functioning as separate sense functions. Their receptivity is there, actually, in the body. Remember this, this is important, because when we come to the end, we'll see why it is important. Their receptivity is there, but there is no reactivity to them from within oneself, and therefore there is no bondage to them. The mind is freed. His mind is pleased with, set free, the words the Buddha uses. Now, infinite vijnana, infinite discriminative consciousness, therefore, does not mean consciousness in our sense of the term. It is this universal all-mind, you may call it no-mind if you like, it doesn't matter which you call it, yes-mind or no-mind. The words make no difference in actual fact. Think of Nagarjuna of those days and what he presented. You know, the basic idea is that to any single proposition, as also to the opposite proposition, you have to give two answers, yes as well as no, to each. So you see, this is the meaning of that. Actually, the brain has to completely shut up. No talking. This is extremely important to understand. No talking at all. Which means no conceptualizing. No forming of limited images or attempting to form limited images of the totality, the total reality. See, if we can just get the feel of it, don't try to, you know, get it into rigid thought. Just get the feel of it. And then something of the reality of this shunyata, this emptiness, this void, will emerge and permeate oneself. Because in that voidness is utter freedom, liberation, and utter purity. Purity in the sense of complete transparency. When there are no clouds at all in the sky during the daytime, the sunlight is there flooding everything around, isn't it? It's a transparency. It's not an emptiness, because we know now that all this so-called, this space which used to be called empty space is just full of innumerable energies functioning through the universe. They are invisible, inaudible, intangible, and so forth. So only when there is a material nucleus available, that those energies can become known to us, whether they be electrical or heat or light or anything else. Now it is the same in terms of the different states of consciousness which we experience in the deeper and deeper states of meditation. And this is what the Buddha was concerned with, the mind. All the great religious teachers were fundamentally healers of the mind. All right. So, infinite vijnana, the all mind becomes a postulate with us, a conceptual postulate. And insofar as the monk pays attention to it, he is tying it up with the grades of mind, the functioning of mind, which is a bind, which is not freedom. From there, he says, not paying attention to infinite vijnana, he pays attention to the no thing. We usually say nothing, but the word nothing is misleading, gives the wrong impression. The no thing. Thing, the word thing, of course, is invariably associated with that which is limited, particular, finite, comes into being, therefore is born, proceeds, dies, and therefore is associated with suffering, pain, lamentation, misery, and all the rest of it. No thing. He gets rid of no thing. Everything previous to that, with regard to everything previous to no thing, the Buddha says, it's very repetitive, as you know, so I'm just going through the steps quickly. The Buddha says, with respect to everything previous to that stage, there is a true realization of emptiness, abiding in the fullness thereof. But with regard to the no-thing itself, there is not yet emptiness. Putting that aside, neither perception nor non-perception. What is the meaning of neither perception nor non-perception? Don't try to imagine. Don't search the corridors of memory or knowledge or study in order to get at it. You get at it by not getting at it. Don't move towards it to get at it, because there is no direction in which you can move. The state of neither perception nor non-perception. These are grades of attentiveness. That is to say, they are intensities of attentiveness. As the intensity of attentiveness becomes greater and greater, more and more intense, you see, the intensity becomes more intense, all particularity, limitation, finitude, which is responsible for our ordinary modes of perception, disappears. You are not attending to anything. You already passed the plane of things when you talk of the plane of no thing. These are extraordinary states of awareness. So now there is that state where there is neither perception nor non-perception. Now you know that in the ordinary way, the Buddha ends up, when he lists these states, by saying that after neither perception nor non-perception, there is the complete cessation of all perception and feeling. The cessation. And when the monk enters the cessation, all the body does not perish during that period. The metabolism is such, the whole life process is such, that time as such stands still. In terms of awareness and in terms of his particular bodily functioning. But it will do so only for a certain number of days. Because nature is the all-powerful fact. there comes a time when he must emerge out of that state, and the ordinary metabolic processes start up again, and the body decays, grows older and older and decays. But instead of going to that stage, the Buddha now proceeds to say that not attending to the state of neither perception nor non-perception, he attends to the solitude dependent upon the concentration of mind that is signless. Vipassana Chitta Samadhi. Signless. That state which is signless. What are the signs? The signs which characterize everything manifested. Anicca, Anatta, Dukkha. Now we translate Anicca as impermanent. Yes, but perhaps a more satisfactory translation would be the relative. Whatsoever is relative appears, proceeds, dies. Impermanent, as we call it. So if we use the word impermanent, we will have an opposite to it, which is permanent, a direct opposite. What is a direct opposite to relative? There is no direct opposite. We sometimes say the absolute is the opposite of relative. It is, but it is an apparent opposite only. The relative is that which is particular, defined, and so forth. There are countless million relative manifestations throughout the universe. But every one of these is subsumed within the one totality, the wholeness, which is the absolute. The indefinable, unperceivable essence, which is wholeness, manifesting as the particular. So, the absolute is not the opposite of any particular relative. It is the origin, the source, and that which reabsorbs the relative into it. So anicca really means that which is not us, not nitya, the Pali is nitya, Sanskrit, and nitya really means that which is eternal, not eternal in the sense of continuity in time and space, which completely transcends the conceptual time-space continuity. That's nitya, a meaning which I think you won't find easily anywhere, even in the writings of the Shankaras and others of the world. But that, I feel, is something like the reality of nitya. And nitya and anicca is that which is relative, which is constrained within the sphere over which death exercises lordship. So you see, the solitude grounded on the concentration of mind that is signless. There is no sign visible there. Anicca is one of those signs that is not there. anatta. Now, of course, I am paddling in dangerous waters with anatta. Atta, the Pali equivalent of the Sanskrit atma, represents that ultimate which is totally beyond conception and description. It is non-descriptive. And yet, the Buddha himself unequivocally makes the supreme affirmation that all the great teachers made. Monks, there is a plane, and he mentioned, beyond fire, air, earth, water, this, that, and the other, everything, and there is that unmade, unborn, unmade, unbecome. For if there were not that, there'd be no, escape is a bad translation in this context, there'd be no release out of. Translate it that way, and you'll see it much, in a much clearer light. There would be no release out of this that is born, that is made, that is become, which is limited, which is confined. You remember, the release is not a release in bodily terms, of course, obviously not. The Buddha himself died like any other decent human being. And all the Buddhas lived and died physically. But in terms of awareness of this total reality, this transcendent fact, the absolute fact, which is a void and emptiness as far as this limited person here, oneself, is concerned. This is the great liberation, and only man on this planet can ever achieve that. Sorry, I put it in a bad way. It's only through man that that phenomenon can show itself. It is the transcendent reality which comes to this kind of self-fruition and self-liberation through the instrument, a human being, you yourself. And this is a manifestation of nirvana. Not that you have attained nirvana. It is that unborn, unbecome, unmade, the absolute, the shunyata itself. All right. So, anatta, therefore, means that all these other states of awareness just come into being, they live their little life, and they dissolve away. What happens with us in the world, in the ordinary way? We just go through all kinds of confused, distorted states of mind due to ignorance and the passion for sentient existence, tanha. We are confused, we are afraid, we cling to self, we cling to this, that, and the other. Let that be out of the way. And the foundation is laid in the finite and the particular for the infinite, the totality, the transcendent, to come to full self-realization through you. After that, when you return to ordinary consciousness, the impress made upon your brain, upon your whole being, your whole psychophysical being, by that transcendent experience. This is the meaning of transfiguration, the real meaning. The impress made upon the whole psychophysical organism is so powerful that if, by nature, by constitution, you're a person whose intellect is very bright, clear-seeing, and can form concepts which are the least misleading concepts that can be presented and you have the gift of verbalizing them, you see, properly, then you can talk about it. And warn everybody that what you are saying is but a veil of the reality. That so much for anatta. So all these other things are anatta in that sense. The atta, he never talks of. The Buddha never talks of. But the word atma fills the pages of the Upanishads. And if you look at the older Upanishads, the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads, it is stated unequivocally in just precisely so many words. That which is birthless, ageless, deathless, stainless, sorrowless, that is the Atma. What does the Buddha say in the Arya Pariyesana Sutta, his autobiographical discourse? So monks, seeking the unborn, the unaging, the undecaying, the undying, the unsorrowing, the unstained, precisely those things he mentions himself. Well, I leave it to you. What did the Buddha seek? So, anatta, that's one of the signs of being, And being means specific being. That means limitation, death. And the third, dukkha. What is dukkha? Is it merely jati, translated as birth, which is quite a correct translation? But don't forget the other connotations of jati, which are far more significant. The conditioned state, that is jati. The word jat, used to this day in India, refers to the particular social group you belong to, the socio-economic group you belong to. That's your jat. And everybody knows that you are conditioned within that socio-economic group. It's a conditioned state. You want to get into another jati, a better one, as you think. Bigger and bigger, like the frog, mother frog, you know, who finally burst. Jati, the succession of jati, fundamentally means the succession of conditioned states of your mind and awareness, your consciousness. That is the real samsara. It is openly taught in the Upanishads, for instance, that samsara is just one's own thought. That is, your own thought process. In your lifetime, from the time you are, well, perhaps you don't really think when you are born. Most people wouldn't be born if they could think at that moment. But once you start thinking, see, expressing your awareness of existence in conceptual terms, your thought process is always a conditioned state of mind. And how is it conditioned? By things. By larger things. By akasha. By vijnana. By noticing, etc., etc. These are all conditioned things. And all these are far from, they are a twisting, a distorting of that absolute reality, which is the inconceivable, the unthinkable, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade, the unbecome. And this is the meaning, the fundamental meaning of dukkham, which is the origin of the word dukkha. The kham is the infinite, or the absolute, if you like. That is its real, that is its literal meaning. And duk means that which is bad, spoiled, ill. This is the fundamental, the ultimate ill state. And it is out of this ill state that the Buddha, like all the great spiritual teachers, tried to help man to free himself from. So these are the signs of being, the signs of limited existence, jati, the conditioned state, birth, if you like. A state of mind is born, it proceeds, it comes to its end, another state of mind emerges. That's your next birth, because you, having the concept, I am I, associated with the actual body whilst it is alive. Your I am I consciousness, awareness, like this misconcept, is the reincarnating thing in your lifetime. This is a reality, this is a fact, beyond doubting. You can perceive it here and now. So, he enters upon the state which is called the signless. He comprehends, the monk comprehends, disturbance due to perception of all those planes right up to neither perception nor non-perception has ceased because he does not pay any attention to them anymore as such. There is only this degree of disturbance. Now note just exactly where the Buddha jumps to from this profound depth of neither perception nor non-perception. He goes on, there is only this degree of disturbance. That is to say, the six sensory fields which, conditioned by life, are grounded on this body itself. This awareness only is not emptiness. Now, see, the six sensory fields, why six? We all know about the five senses which we talk of in the Western world. In India, they always talked of the mind, that is to say, the discursive mind, the mental processes which are associated with each living human being, each living human body, that is the sixth. They call that a sense. A sensory field. And these six, sight, hearing, etc., including this discursive mind process, constitute the salayatana, the six sensory fields, which, conditioned by life, remember, whilst you are alive only, they are there. At death, there is the complete dissolution of all of that. Nothing remains over. Are grounded, are dependent on this body alone. This awareness only is not emptiness. Now, the Buddha goes on and he repeats this previous statement. See? Solitude grounded on the concentration of mind that is silence. And then he goes on to say, this concentration of mind that is signless is affected and thought out. Because the perception of it necessarily means that you are right back into the body. And the body just functions in terms of putting together the different impressions, synthesizing what impression? The sense impression. empty. So this is the only not emptiness that remains with you as long as there is a body, a living body. The Buddha puts it in clearer terms and in a much better psychological analysis than the Upanishads do. The Upanishads talk of what they call the Jivan Mukti and the Videha Mukti, the liberation whilst alive in the body and after the death of the body, the dissolution of the body. But the Upanishads, as they stand, are slightly misleading in the actual verbal formulation. The Buddha's formulation is much clearer. So he says, this concentration of mind that is signless is affected and thought of. Abhisankatam. Sankata means to put together. It is not an integration, it is a mechanical synthesis. It's not a live integration. It's a mechanical synthesis. And it is thought out. Abhisanchetiyatam. Those are the words he uses. Hence, this concentration of mind is also anicca, anatta, dukkha, and therefore liable to nirodha, to dissolution, to passing away. Now we come to the really important point, the crux of the whole thing. Knowing and seeing this thus, that is the whole question of the shunya, the emptiness. And to what extent emptiness can be realized in mind and consciousness, and not just chatted about and writing mighty tomes about it. So, knowing and seeing this thus, his mind is freed from the asavas. And the asavas are translated as cankers. It's a legitimate translation, perhaps. But how do we think of cankers? We think of some other thing which is sort of eating us up, biting into us. We use a word like cancer for something which really... We think of cankers as a something other which causes us pain, disease, and so forth. That's a canker. Or another human being who is such a nuisance that we say, oh, he's a canker. Now, the literal meaning of asavas, I feel, will take us closer to the reality. An asava is an exudation, an overflow, an outflow. You know how we get rubber from a rubber tree, we just make an incision, and lo and behold, the latex flows out. That is an asava, that's flowing out of the latex. The Buddha was a healer of the mind. What are the things that are the sources of bondage? Karma, sense pleasure, the pursuit of sense pleasure, sense love, karma, bhava, the passion to become. I'm going to be the foreman. I'm going to be the town clerk. I'm going to be the king of the castle. These are the bhavas which we all suffer from. I'm going to be an arhat. I'm going to be a buddha. I'm going to realize nirvana.
you never will do anything of the sort. Cut that clean out of your mind. If you become pure in your life, understand self and see what are the illusions and delusions with which we are beset, really see them, then they just naturally dissolve. You don't cast them off as if they were something, some foreign matter in your psychical system. The psyche itself undergoes that transformation by which it is light and no longer dark. So you will never become these things. But if there is this purification, and if there is the attentiveness, then this mysterious, unknown, unknowable process, which is the universal process, this absolute, if you like to call it, or if you are theistically minded God, if you like to so name it, or Buddha nature, if you so like to name it what you will, comes to fruition through you without being obstructed by your knowing in personalistic terms, oh, I have done this. Unfortunately, in all the texts in the Pali canon, the impression is that the monk knows, and it says, destroyed is birth, destroyed is becoming so and so, for the person himself. For the person himself, the I, that is the little error that has crept in by implication in the text. There is no I. What has happened is that there will be no succession of conditioned states in your own mind and consciousness. Just naturally there will be no conditioned states arising. No association of this misconcept of I am I with every particular state that comes into being. And when there is no association like that, the mind is free, it's no longer bound. It is not detached, but it is non-attached. It is awake to the truth, the becoming process, which of course must be there whilst you're alive. See? But being unattached, this wonderful thing which is freedom, inward poise and peace, has come to fruition in your own being. This is the thing that one has to realize. And so, bhava asava, the exudation is out. And the exudation which is called avidya, exudation. Now, why do I use the word exudation? If your awareness has, in deep meditation, gone into this supreme state, you come out of it in the ordinary way, and you react to external stimuli in terms of the uprising of passion for any sort of sense pleasure or sense indulgence. Happiness will be there through the senses. How can you prevent yourself from being happy with a lovely sunset or a rose or meeting a friend or anything like that? You can't prevent happiness. And that is the real happiness. You don't cling to it. But when you say to yourself, oh, I want to enjoy this, that and the other particular thing, then the devil's got you. You see? It's that. So your consciousness does not overflow into this ill state, mistaking the ill state for the eternal reality of happiness. Happiness is constitutive of your being. It hasn't got to be sought. You've got a nose, haven't you? You don't seek a nose. You don't pursue a nose. You've got it. You see? If you get proud of it. Oh. Then you experience dukkha, far from the infinite spot.
Right.
So these exudations are the exudations, the asavas are the overflows of consciousness into the state which is conditioned, which is not the ultimate truth, the absolute reality, and which is therefore dukkha. And then finally, the state of avijja. That state of consciousness in which you are liable to delusion, and you experience actually illusions because you build up all kinds of imaginary pictures. See? So this is the real meaning of asava. And when he sees that even the ultimate signless concentration is affected and thought out, all clinging is gone. All clinging is gone, but complete sensitivity and the awakened state is there, present. And therefore he knows, kina jati, translated destroyed is jati, translated this way, done away with is entanglement in the conditioned state. And you'll get a much clearer understanding of what it means. Not destroyed is birth. You've got quite the wrong concept about this. Destruction of birth and rebirth stuff. Usitam brahmacharyam. Lived is the holy life. Not lived in the sense of I've finished it and I've got my degree now. Not in that sense. Fulfilled, but fulfilled not in the past tense, but as a continuous present. It's a continuous present tense. Continuously lived is the holy life, the Brahma Charya, the walking in Brahma, to Brahma, through Brahma. This is only an Indian form of saying what we have in Christian teaching. In him we live and move and have our being. Katam karaniyam. Done what there had to be done. Naparam ittatayati pajanati. And he knows that now there is no more of being caught up in this, that and the other state. Past, present, future, they have all become one great timeless reality in this condition of liberation. And this condition of liberation is the condition in which the reality, the truth of the Shunya has come to perfect manifestation through you who are not void, not empty,